The last national crisis before coronavirus was the Second World War. Everybody was expected to do their bit. Men went to war and women were conscripted to do man's work, however dirty, noisy and dangerous. Today, we're talking to the Sheffield-based journalist, Michelle Rawlins, who has written a book celebrating the feisty factory sisters who helped win the war, Women of Steel, which is published by Headline. Hi, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, Josephine. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Michelle, tell our listeners, who are the Women of Steel?
So the Women of Steel are this remarkable, amazing generation of women who lived in Sheffield or the surrounding areas during World War II. And when war broke out and all the menfolk went off to fight, they became this troop or army of women that filled their roles in the Sheffield steel factories that lined the River Don, that made the munitions and parts for the aircraft Spitfires to help win the war. So they made what the Allied troops needed to fight Hitler, really.
The thing is, these women, that the fashions at those time were to wear gloves and hats, to be ladylike. These women had to go and do a very scary, this isn't just a normal job, it's a scary job, isn't it?
Absolutely scary. And you know, the point that you make there about their clothing was a huge element for them, because, you know, these ladies had never worn trousers. They wore skirts and dresses, and trousers were only just coming into fashion for women. And even then they were advertised as trousers that slipped over your hips like skirts. So to actually go from wearing their lovely, beautifully styled clothing to wearing boiler suits and overalls and really mucky ones at that was a huge change for them. And although it might sound very little in today's age, at that point in time, it was a massive cultural difference for them and something that actually really upset them. You know, these women would go home on their first day at work and they would cry because they had to wear overalls. So they'd get their mums and their grannies and their aunts to tailor them. They'd nip and tuck them so it showed off their curves still and a little bit of their femininity. And that was obviously just one element of working in these disgusting, huge, dirty factories that were horrifically dangerous. The job itself was so dangerous. You know, people lost their lives, lost limbs, were decapitated, were descalped. You know, there was no health and safety. We had foremen that told them what to do, but there was no sort of rules and regulations apart from a foreman yelling, "Don't do that," if it was dangerous. You know, so they had to learn fast and they had to learn on their feet. And they came from, apart from sectors of the women that came from who were buffer girls or who'd worked in, some had worked in the cotton mills, a lot of these women came from really lovely jobs, like they were nannies or they were in service in lovely households or they were companions for elderly neighbours. So to go from working in a beautiful, tranquil, idyllic environment to one of these huge, deafening factories, you know, they literally described it as to walking into hell on earth. So it, massive change for them. And I think it was so undernoted for a long time. You know, once war finished, they were forgotten about. And it was only decades later that anyone actually started to think about, gosh, what did these women actually do?
We'll talk about that later. I just want to go more into their conditions in the factory. I mean, and also, can you tell me their different roles? I was very interested in the crane drivers.
The crane drivers.
Tell me a story about them.
Yeah, the crane drivers were amazing. I mean, some of the women, they said, "I can't go up them ladders, I can't." And they couldn't. They were genuinely terrified of heights. But one story, which I'll never forget, is a lady called Dorothy Slingsby. And she was quite a petite little lady, a bit of a waif of a girl. And she was adamant. She was quite a campaigning woman. She always wanted to help, do a bit. So she went to the factories and she wanted to be a crane driver. And the foreman almost laughed at her and said, "You know, you can't do a man's job." And he said, they were stood in front of one of the ladders that took them up to the crane cabs. And he said, "You know, if that's where you've got to go, right up into the ceilings of this factory." And while he was still talking or finishing his sentence, she ran up the ladder right to the top and looked down at him and sort of gave her him a knowing smile as if to say, don't tell me I can't do this job. Anyway, she came back down and, you know, he was obviously a little bit flabbergasted and said, I didn't actually expect you to show me, but obviously she got the job. She got the job. And what was interesting is the crane drivers, as women, faced a few battles. There's a story in the book about a lady who, they were all partnered up with someone more experienced to begin with to show them the rope, and a very touchy-feely man who obviously took advantage of a young 17-year-old girl being in his crane cab and was touching her legs far too much. And she finally had enough and said to him, if you touch my legs once more, I am actually going to throw you out of this cab.
Yay!
I know. And what was even more impressive is the fact that she confronted him, which was, you know, very hard for a woman, especially a young woman in that time. But when she got back down to the ground, she spoke to her foreman and told him. And he, as opposed to ignoring it or laughing it off, said, thank you for telling me. We'd heard this was happening with this particular worker. He will now be moved to a male-only part of the factory.
I think that's incredible. Yeah,
I know. And to have that bravery, as such a young girl, you know, we're talking teenage girls here who could easily be very intimidated. And there was lots of stories about this where women in certain factories, if even walking through the factories to go for their lunch, had to be escorted by a supervisor or a foreman, because obviously these were big male orientated factories. So to suddenly have some young attractive girls amongst the mixed would cause that sort of attention, unwanted attention. And again, there was no guidelines that they weren't allowed to do this. So probably many of them got away with it, but, you know, I absolutely salute the women who stood up to this. And the job itself was fairly dangerous, you know. I heard so many stories about the sirens going off and women being trapped in their cabs because the ladders up to the gantries hadn't been moved back to the cab. So they'd have to crawl along these gantries that, you know, were quite narrow to find the ladders. This is all while there's an air raid siren going off, to come down the ladders and run hell for leather to the air raid shelters. So it was, you know, it was a precarious job. The positive, though, and there was a positive, is the fact that the foreman generally conceded, as war went on, the women were better crane drivers than the men because they had a more delicate hand. So they weren't like a herd of elephants lifting and dropping things. They had precision detail in picking things up and placing these big steel girders or plates of steel where they were meant to be without causing any damage.
So impressive that these women were so assertive. I mean, to think even nowadays it's hard for us to kind of be, you know, get on top of things like that. Can you tell me about accidents? Because there were some horrific stories.
Really horrific stories. And I think the thing was, a lot of our young girls that entered the factories, whose dads had maybe worked in the steel industry or were a bit older, maybe they'd been in the First World War, they really didn't want their daughters to go, really didn't want. Lots of arguments about no daughter of mine's entering a factory, they're too dangerous, surrounded by lecherous men, you know, there was lots of these tales. And with, you know, for good reason, men were decapitated. There was stories of men used to still wear silk scarves. And there was one story in particular which really harrowed me, was his scarf got caught in a lathe and it literally decapitated him.
Oh.
I know, horrific. But then there was other stories, like women loved their hair and it was a real style point for women. They're very feminine. Lots of them still had quite long hair and they wanted to show it off. And especially when they were wearing boiler suits, it was the one part of their femininity they could still be very stylish about and celebrate. But they were supposed to wear mop caps in certain jobs, and there was one lady who had forgotten her mop cap one particular night shift, and her foreman had said, no, you must go home, go and get your mop cap, you can't work. And she said, no, I can't lose my wages, because her wages would have been docked for missing an hour's work or however long it took. So she insisted on working, and lo and behold, her long curly hair got trapped in one of the belts and literally de-scalped her.
Oh.
And so the belt's going round and round, and her hair is literally getting ripped out until somebody pressed the emergency stop button.
Was she scarred for life?
Yeah. Yes, I believe so. I mean, the blood, you know, it was one of her colleagues that told me the story, and 70 years on, she still remembers it very vividly, had the screams of pain, and this poor woman, literally half her head discarded. Oh. So, I mean, these are just a couple of the stories. One of the factories would have a big Bessemer converter, which all the molten steel would go in and sparks would fly off, hot sparks. And one lady said to me, you risk life and limb being near it. So they would put sacks over their heads to run past it. But she said the sparks were that hot, they could burn through the sack, mm-hmm. or it could catch your mm-hmm. arm and you'd be scarred for life. So these were horrifically dangerous factories. And you sort of think about the obvious big things like that, you know, being a crane driver or the lathes and not wearing mop caps, but even things like lifting materials. So the women were expected to lift these big steel heavy coils or the bombs that were being made. One lady put her back out completely. And then it was quite ironic. They tried to help her. So they put her in a Leicester truck, which is designed to carry raw materials, and wheeled her out of the factory across a cobbled pavement. So her back jolted more and more. And she's convinced actually being wheeled out caused her back more damage than actually lifting this big heavy steel coil. And to this day, she's still one of the ladies that's still with her. She's 98. Her back still plays up due to that one incident.
Wow. Now, I do want to get to you, you know, talking to the older women, but I just want to find out what sort of backgrounds and what, you know, you say people come from good backgrounds, but a lot of women came from very deprived backgrounds.
They did. They came from very poverty-stricken backgrounds. Obviously, the country was just recovering from a huge economic depression. We're living in Yorkshire, where one of the main employers is either the steel industry or you're a miner. Neither of these are hugely well-paid jobs. Obviously, they're manual, laborious jobs with, you know, very small wage packets. So, they were already from deprived backgrounds. I mean, you know, I spoke to women who shared bedrooms with cockroaches and, you know, had to flee in midnight flits because they couldn't pay the rent man anymore. You know, we're talking real poverty. And then, of course, you enter a war, and quite quickly into the war, you have rations and you've got your family members away at war. So wages coming in are quite limited. So a lot of families did come from fairly poverty-stricken backgrounds. So they were on the tougher side of the women who joined the factories. And you know, obviously their personalities shone through. So when you get a divide then from the wealthier girls who wanted to do their bit to the girls that have been the buffer girls or dads were coal miners, and there was that real mix of personalities going on, and they had to get used to each other.
And class, really.
Yes, you know. A massive class. Yep. You'd get the rougher girls who would think, oh gosh, they're a bit posh, I don't want to talk to them. And then the girls who came from wealthier backgrounds would be like, oh my God, those girls are so rough, I can't talk to them. But what was lovely is there was that edge of animosity at the beginning, but very quickly that dispersed. And these women became a team, no matter what their background. They gelled, they had a lovely camaraderie about them, a lovely bond. They shared everything from secrets to lipstick to wedding dresses. One wedding dress would go around a whole factory to make sure a bride looked beautiful on her big day. So those that did come from sort of the harsher side of Sheffield soon found friends who could help them financially, not by giving them money, but by helping them with things that they needed, just so that their lives were a little bit nicer.
Amazing. Now, so Michelle, you have the task, which must have been fascinating, of meeting all these amazing women. I mean, how old are they now?
Well, as I say, Kathleen, who I mentioned, is 98.
Yeah.
The oldest lady, who has sadly now passed away, Dot Reardon, was 105 when I interviewed her.
Wow.
And her opening statement was, I belong on someone's mantelpiece. And I wouldn't mind, but she was so sprightly and so... She was so full of energy. She had poor eyesight and she was in a care home due to her eyesight. But her memory was vivid. And that's what I found so fascinating about meeting many of these ladies is their memories. When they talked about their time in the war, you'd think they were talking about something that happened last week. Their attention to detail was phenomenal. I was just blown away by the minute detail. Kathleen telling me how the day war was announced and she'd gone home, the church service, it was Sunday morning, church had been cut short because there was an announcement coming from Neville Chamberlain. And she remembers walking into her kitchen and can still remember the aroma of roast lamb cooking in the oven. And, you know, I struggle to remember sometimes what I did yesterday, but these ladies are remembering things that happened, you know, over seven decades ago. So it was a truly privileged and honoured thing to do, to interview these ladies. And I do feel genuinely very privileged that I've been able to capture their memories and turn them into print and record them for, you know, generations to come. One of the things that came out when I was interviewing the ladies is from family members who'd said, we've never heard this story. We're so grateful that you're recording them because we want to show our children, you know, and our grandchildren what Granny did in the war, because it's so important that we remember these stories, and they're absolutely right. So I feel very grateful that I got to meet these ladies and talk to them about their times.
I'm wondering why, I mean, the attitude of women was so different then. I mean, they didn't get equal pay, they were sexism, but they just thought, I'll get on with it. They never seemed to complain. Why are we so different than them?
And you know, it's very funny you mention that, because just yesterday somebody reviewed the book on Amazon and that was the point they made. It was very much, you know, everybody moans these days. We moan about the smallest thing and, you know, we've moaned about the lockdown, we've moaned about coronavirus. But, you know, this generation lived with the war for 6 years and sometimes longer, because, you know, the men didn't all come home dead on war ending, you know, it was months later for some of them. Their attitude, their work ethic was second to none. You know, we're talking 12 hours a day in mucky, dirty factories with really intensive physical work. Some of them not seeing their children at all. You know, some of these ladies had to literally hand their children to grandmas, and they would see them over a weekend. You know, we just wouldn't do that today. There's no way I would hand over my 3-month-old baby to go and work in a dirty factory. They had little to celebrate. So they made their own joy, you know, singing all day, keep them going. Or having enough money just to go to the cinema at the weekend was a real treat, or to go to one of the dances. But it literally, every woman I interviewed said to me, we didn't moan, we just got on with it. Now, that attitude obviously is phenomenal. And where it came from, it must stem from their own backgrounds, because they came from hardship. So there was no point in moaning because they weren't going to change the situation. But what they really wanted to do, which was, again, a significant underlying line throughout the whole 6 years, is they wanted to do their bit no matter what. You know, I spoke to one lady, Dot, who was 105, who had a beautiful job in Surrey when war broke out, in working as a nanny. And as soon as war was announced, she handed her notice in and got the next train back to Sheffield. And not because she'd been conscripted, not because she'd been told she had to do it. She just felt she had to get home to her home city and help the city survive the war.
So it was much more patriotic, I can't say the word. And there was also, they wanted to give back more, didn't they?
They definitely wanted to give back. And I think there was the element, and I suppose if you look at what's happening now, or what's happened in the last 3 months, where we've got lots of lovely WhatsApp groups for communities to help those that are vulnerable, there was this element that all their menfolk, it could be their brothers, their husbands, their partners, their cousins, were off fighting a war. they couldn't just do nothing. They were very much, if my boyfriend's off, you know, fighting Hitler, then I can't just sit here and carry on working in the sweet shop or carry on, you know, working as a nanny. They wanted to do something significant that counted, that would make an impact to the war effort.
It's fantastic, Michelle. And then tell us about the statue that's been erected for them.
I mean, the statue is tremendous. So it was commissioned from a sculptor called Martin Jennings. And what's wonderful about the statue is it wasn't paid for by any one business. It wasn't a corporate event. It was a grassroots campaign that the city of Sheffield, the population of Sheffield, would pay for it. So there was no donations allowed over £1,000 because the whole initiative was that it wouldn't be surrounded by sponsored plaques that any one business had paid for it. And there was offers for people, for big businesses, to pay for the statue. But right from the very start, it was no, this has got to be a thank you to the women from the city they served. So it took 6 years to raise the money. And I felt very sorry for Martin Jennings, because the old ladies, bless them, kept saying to him, you need to get a move on, we're not going to be here to see it unveiled. Wow. And when I interviewed him, he said he felt under such pressure because, you know, he really wanted to create this amazing statue that really personified what the women did. But he was so conscious that, you know, he wanted them to see it. So,
Can you describe it?
Yes, so it's two women, and it's a larger-than-life statue, so it's taller, it's bigger. But what's really interesting and fundamental about the statue is that the women have got their arms around each other in the statue, but then their other arm is on their hips, so people can go and link it. So they can go and link their hips with the Women of Steel, and it was designed with that in mind, that statue that was just on a pedestal that people admired and looked at, that they literally go and link arms and they become part of this movement to celebrate the Women of Steel and what they were. So on Instagram, all over the internet, you know, there's thousands of pictures of linking arms with the Women of Steel. My own children have done it, and it's a lovely, lovely recognition to them, and a very worthy one too.
Michelle, you have been a lovely interviewee. I've just enjoyed talking to you. I could talk to you all day about the Women of Steel. I mean, I just think we've got a lot to learn from them, don't you?
Absolutely. If we can follow in their footsteps and just take one lesson out of the many that they delivered, then I think we'll go a long way.
And so Women of Steel is published by Headline and amassed and written by Michelle Rawlins. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous today.
Thank you for having me.